We'll come to order. It's about 2:06. I'm going to call this informational meeting to order on the tax omnibus bill, which of course has not been introduced, but it is revisor copy number 19-5224. And the purpose of this meeting is, as I mentioned, informational. To go over the bill, and we'll have the way I would like it to work today is for staff to do an overview of the bill. I'm going to be asking them that they kind of cover the major parts that were in the original House bill that left the House, and then any new items. And then members, if we have any kind of questions just specific to the bill, we'll take that at that time. Then we'll open it up to testimony, and then when testimony is complete, members, we can discuss what's in the bill. Of course, there will be no votes, and Representative Hertaus, no amendments. So I know you said you came with several, but they're not allowed today.
I brought 25.
Okay, very good. So with that, just this is a good chance before going into a special session that we can actually have time, which I think is unique in the 19 years I've been here, and we've been through many special sessions, and as one of our colleagues, Representative Pawlowski, says, special sessions are not that special anymore. And so this is a way in which we can look, and if there's things we can still correct before the bill is introduced, so we'll have the spreadsheet and all those things.
Mr.
So,
Chairman,
yes, Representative Carlson.
When you talk about unique special sessions, I was here when Governor Cui was governor, and we had six special sessions in rather short order.
He was at my
about 1 month.
Oh, sounds painful.
Well, when what the big problem for many members was, you know, they'd just get back to their regular job because we had adjourned, and they'd get notice another special session, and they go back to work and another special session. So it got kind of rocky for several of the members in that regard.
I'm sure it did. But Representative Hertaus.
To that point, there were only seven special sessions in the first 75 years of statehood. Then there were another 14 in the next 40 years. And then there were 29 from 1975 until now. In the last 40 years, this will be the 30th one. And you're right, they're not very special. They're rather ordinary. And it's getting to be a problem.
Representative Carlson.
They began to escalate, if you look at the history of those, during those years, when Governor Cui was in office.
Before we go any further, there have been a lot of people who have put in very long nights here, especially these last couple weeks. And so before we go any further, I want to thank the staff. And we've got Mr. Williams and Mr. Clayman up front who will be presenting first. And in the back, Mr. Swanson, Ms. Templin, Ms. Hagler, Ms. Schill, Ms. Dalton right there. Thank you so much for all of your work, and we're not done yet. And so House Research staff, thank you so much. Up here at the front table, Ms. Griska, thank you so much. Committee Administrator, Mr. Jessen, that things would just not be able to happen without his great efforts. We also have Partisan Research, Mr. Haydorn, thank you so much. Mr. Rubis, thank you. To the conferees, Representative Gomez, Representative Loeffler, Vice Chair Les Lagarde, thank you very much. Chair Davids, I talked to him this morning. He was planning to be here if he could, but today he is in La Crescent cutting ribbon for a new convention and hotel in La Crescent. Remember, there's a lodging tax here. This is seeing what we do right here at this table. And so that's where Representative Davids is right now. And then, of course, I want to thank all the members, not only members of the Tax Committee, but also we have members here from the Property Tax Division. And a lot of work goes into producing something that will make a difference. So just a little update on, or preview of what we did, or review, is that the conferees did meet prior to the end of session, met 10 times. We met 10 times, and during that time, the conferees actually adopted about 75 provisions, which really helped lessen the workload once we kind of got into after the session. And we probably debated, in addition to those 75 items, probably another 25 items that we actually discussed in conference committee. And so we made a lot of headway there. And then once the global agreement was made on Sunday, and then the agreement was refined a little bit more on Monday, there's been folks as we kind of put the final bill together. And what you see then is this final result. And, of course, much of the bill that you are seeing right now are all bills that were heard in the House and passed the House floor. So much of this bill is not new. And when we set out this year, we wanted to, in this committee, create a tax bill that worked for everyone everywhere, that really moved the dial, that really improved the quality of life, create a tax system that was simpler and more accountable and more affordable. And I think in this bill, through the House and the Senate, in this legislature, we've done that. And so, you know, the one major goal that was in the House proposal that is not achieved here was to raise revenue for investments into the future. And I do think the budget we have is a good budget. I think there probably were some missed opportunities, but that's also part of compromise. But I think as far as the tax portion that we have right now is going to make a difference in people's lives around the state and improve the quality of life and cut taxes for our working families and our seniors and our farmers and our small businesses, and that's really important. So let me just kind of go over a little quick overview of what is in the bill. The big reform and really the marquee item is the doubling of the standard deduction. This is conforming to the federal government, doubling the standard deduction to $24,400, rolling in the personal exemptions into that standard deduction, but also keeping the dependent exemption so you still have the family size adjustment. And so let me give you just what that means. According to House research, is that now 92.5%, almost 93% of all Minnesota filers now will take the standard deduction. That is greatly going to simplify the system. Also, if you couple this with the second tier rate decrease that was adopted in here, that was part of the Senate proposal, on the average median household income of about $68,000, and on the average family median income of about $86,000, the tax cut will be about 7%. So that actually is pretty significant. And one other kind of interesting point is that for a family of four, if you take the $24,400 deduction and add the $8,500 dependent exemptions, that comes to $32,900, which means Minnesota basically will have a zero tax bracket of $32,900, which means a family of four will not pay any income taxes for the first $32,900 of their income, which among the states that have income taxes, that now will be the third highest zero tax bracket. And that is a huge benefit for working families. Adding on to that, we in the House bill, a significant investment in working family credit. And the major emphasis is conforming to the federal earned income tax credit by including expanding it to families with three children or more. That was the big expansion there. And so that is part of this bill. There is going to be significant property tax relief. There is increases on local government aid and county program aid. In the first year, it's $26 million in each of those programs, and then we get to the $30 million into the next years. And that will get us back to the 2002 levels of local government aid funding. For farmers, the agricultural school bond credit, which is going to be huge for farmers and rural schools, that credit, it's a little bit of a step-up process, but in the first year, it goes from 40% credit to 50 for taxes payable 2020, and then the next year goes to 55%, 60%, and in 2023 payable taxes, it will hit at 70%, and that will be a significant property tax relief, but also create more parity among school districts in rural Minnesota. So we also, in here, you'll notice a number of local option sales taxes, a number of tax increment financing districts there, and with the Senate rate cut that was added to this, that will be the first income tax rate cut since 2000. So that was part of the Senate bill, and also, which was in this bill and part of the Senate bill, is a $50 million property tax cut to commercial industrial on the CI levy. And they say we, Representative Les Legarde had offered a bill that would have gone raising the 100,000 to 125 or 150, and this kind of goes the other way. But at any rate, it's a $50 million cut. And the last thing I want to mention is that this does repeal the sunset of the provider tax. And the fact is that if we did not renew it, it would have gone away after December 31st, 2019. That tax would have gone away. We know that. But the reality is, and the impact on people's pocketbooks, is that folks will pay 10% less in their provider tax this next year than they did last year. And so when you take this bill overall with the tax cuts on the income side, the property tax side, you are going to see tax cuts for our working families and our senior citizens and our farmers and our small businesses. They will pay less, even with the provider tax, the sunset being repealed. People will pay less than they did the year before. So with that, again, thank you for everyone who's had a big impact on putting this bill together. And with that, we're going to start with the overview. We have Mr. Clayman and Mr. Williams. So you should have a – are you going to work off the House research document there?
Yes,
Mr. Clayman. Sure. Yes. Okay. So, and if again, if you could kind of look at those areas that are big changes – even made in the House, and then any other changes that were added in conference committee.
Sure.
So, thank you.
Yep. And Mr. Chair and members, I'll do somewhat more of a broad overview of what you see in the House research summary that's in front of you today. So, starting with Article 1, this is the federal conformity article. With respect to the the federal conformity article updates the federal or updates the state tax code to the federal internal revenue code. There have been a number of federal changes over the past few years. The most significant is the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, or the TCJA, in 2017. Article 1 conforms to the TCJA. Essentially, in Article 1, this bill takes the House technical administrative approach to conformity. And what that means is that this bill does retroactive conformity, but we have a special adjustment for tax year 2018. And what the adjustment does is it holds the state and taxpayers harmless, which means no assessments, no refunds due to the retroactivity in that year. But it does allow state income tax returns to nonetheless line up with what the federal returns are going to be on an ongoing basis. There are some provisions that are accepted from this adjustment, which is done where necessary to prevent administrative complexity, especially when it comes to losses and how losses carry over from one year to the next. This bill takes most of the TCJA's base broadeners, but not the international provisions, so that's one key difference from the House bill as it left the House from the bill you see before you today. For instance, some of the base broadeners that are in this bill relate to limitations on excess business losses by pass-throughs, net operating losses, which were reduced at the federal level The House bill retains the corporate NOL provision, which reduces those corporate NOLs to allow an 80% deduction instead of 100%, which is current law. And there are also some employer deductions, which are part of the base broadeners, which were always in this bill. As I mentioned before, this bill does not tax the international income, the international provisions of the TCJA, so there are subtractions for both global intangible low-taxed income and the deemed repatriation income. There is also no GILTI trigger tax in this version of the bill. That's another difference from the House Omnibus Tax Bill in this bill. There is also included as part of the base broadeners are the income limit on the interest deduction. That changed at the federal level. But there is clarifying language that is in this bill relating to how that should be administered. That language was actually in, I believe it was the second engrossment of the omnibus tax bill for a couple days. That is in this bill, and that just clarifies that provision will be administered in the manner provided under federal law. This bill also conforms to the TCJA's more generous depreciation deductions. This is for Section 179 and bonus depreciation. However, the bill, another difference between the House tax bill and this bill is that the state 80% add back is retained. So the status quo on how those depreciation deductions are taken at the state level are still in there. In addition, this tax bill takes the Senate position on the historic structure credit, which requires a five-year installment payment for payment of that credit or grant under the state historic structure credit. Finally, the last business-related provision I'll mention is that the corporate AMT, the alternative minimum tax for corporations, is not repealed by this bill. That was the same as the omnibus tax bill. That concludes the overview of some of the business provisions in the conformity article, and Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Williams to dig into the individual income tax side.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to, for individuals, the omnibus tax bill broadly takes the same structure that was in the House omnibus tax bill as it left the floor. I'm just going to mention briefly some of the key changes that are included in the bill and also some differences from the Senate bill and the positions that were taken. So the bill moves the state to federal adjusted gross income as the starting point for the state income tax. As Chair Markwart mentioned, it matches the federal standard deduction amounts. It also phases out the standard deduction using the same rules that the that itemized deductions are phased out, so it's phased down to by 80%. So the most you'll be phased down is down to 20% of your standard deduction amount. The bill rolls personal exemptions into the standard deduction, as Chair Markwart mentioned. It also retains dependent exemptions. For itemized deductions, there's sort of three main differences between the House and Senate bills. So the Senate bill allowed a deduction for taxes paid up to $15,000, and the House allowed the deduction for $10,000. It takes the House position. For unreimbursed employee expenses, the Senate raised the AGI threshold to 5%, and the House, the omnibus tax bill retains the House position, which is a 2% AGI floor for unreimbursed employee expenses. The Senate retained the deduction for other miscellaneous deductions that were subject to the 2% floor, and the House disallows those other miscellaneous deductions. They're broadly called for other expenses related to the cost of producing income and tax preparation services. The bill does not conform to the TCJA's rules regarding Section 529 college savings plans and allowing saving distributions from 529 plans to pay for K through 12 tuition. And then the bill adopts chain CPI to index provisions of the income tax, individual income tax, the corporate franchise tax, and the property tax refund programs. And unless there are questions about the conformity article, we'll move on to Article 2. I think Mr. Klayman will start.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 2 is the income, corporate franchise, and estate tax article. The first provision is the angel credit. This is funded at 1 year for $10 million beginning in tax year 2021. That's closer to the Senate's position. However, the House provisions regarding the investment threshold for Greater Minnesota or women and minority-owned businesses was retained, And in addition, this bill includes Senate language to add veteran-owned businesses to those targeted businesses, and those veteran-owned businesses will also qualify for that lower investment threshold. Both the medical cannabis subtraction and the elimination of the dividend received deduction on debt-financed stock are in this bill. That was in both the House and the Senate bills, or those two provisions were in both bills. In addition, this bill includes the House provision on how to apportion mutual fund manager income that is from a partnership, and that just lines it up with how corporations, mutual fund managers that are corporations, have their income apportioned. And that's to the state where the shareholders reside. In addition, this bill takes a number of Senate provisions that were not in the House bill. There's a provision that provides automatic equitable relief, which is a type of innocent spouse relief that's granted at the federal level. There's also a Senate provision in this bill that allows a penalty waiver for certain underpayments that are attributable to conformity-related tax planning issues. That includes both for individuals and corporations. There is also an estate tax provision that was in the Senate bill that is in this bill regarding expansion of the range of property that qualifies for the qualified small business and farm property subtractions under the estate tax. And this would allow a greater range of spousal property to qualify for the three-year ownership test under that provision. And I would also mention that the estate tax freeze at $2.7 million that was in the House bill is not in this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Williams for the rest of Article 2.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to discuss what I would describe as the sort of subtractions and credit provisions of Article 2, and then also the rate changes. So as Chair Markwart mentioned, the bill cuts the second-tier individual income tax from rate from 7.05% to 6.8%. The bill also lowers the threshold for the fourth-tier individual income tax bracket. The decrease is about $4,000 for married couples filing joint returns. So what that does is it projects more income to the 9.85% rate instead of the 7.85% rate. The decrease in the bracket threshold is not enough to fully offset the sort of tax cut benefit that people paying on the fourth tier receive from the second tier rate cut, but it partially offsets that. And if you're interested in the math of that, there's an example described on page 23 of the summary. The bill also expands the working family credit. There's a table on page 24 of the summary that sort of describes the parameters under the current law forecasts and under the bill. The sort of two big changes are increases in the credit for taxpayers that don't have any qualifying children, and then increases in the credit for taxpayers with three or more children. There's very minor changes to the phase-outs for taxpayers with one or two children. I'm going to discuss here a provision that's thematically related. That's actually in Article 11, which Ms. Hagler, I believe, will discuss later. The bill, under current law, a certain amount of federal money from the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program pays for the refundable portion of the working family credit, and the bill repeals that. So essentially, the full amount of refundable tax credits under the working family credit will be paid out of the general fund, and so there won't be any federal TANF money used to pay for working family credit refunds. The bill also increases the Social Security subtraction. There's a description of the amounts on page 22 in the summary. The Social Security subtraction will increase about $450 for married couples filing joint returns and $360 for single and head of household tax filers. And that concludes Article 2.
Thank you very much. Let's bring up the next team or person, I guess. Ms. Dalton,
Mr.
we must be getting near sales tax.
I am a team of one. I'm going to take us briefly through Article 3, the sales tax article. The first thing I want to mention is something that was not in either the House and Senate bill, and that is changes to the June accelerated payment percentages, which occur in Sections 2, 4, 16, and 17. The global agreement required that this bill be balanced at zero in both the current biennium and the out biennium, and this was the balancing mechanism at the very end. And so the June accelerated payment percentage goes from the current 81.4% up to 87.5% for the next 2 years, and then is reduced back down to 84.5% for June 2022 and thereafter. That's the major addition. The article contains the Marketplace Provider Act technical corrections, but does not include the provider report. There's a number of sales tax construction exemptions for local governments. This is essentially what was in the House bill, except it was limited to the fire departments, police departments, and the one school district that was in that bill. The number of exemptions for minor nonprofit organizations, many of them were dropped. However, we did keep the one for the Thaler Ice Arena and for Farm America, and the exemption for county fairs to use to pay for their upgrade and upkeep of their facilities. My bill summary says there's a temporary sales tax exemption for film production. That is not in anymore. The herbicide exemption was kept. The exemptions for fires in Melrose and Mazeppa were kept. And that pretty much describes Article 3.
Thank you very much. And Representative Petersburg, how many times did you come to the well for the farm? So a number six for Farm America.
Thank you.
Thanks for your doggedness on that. All right, Mr. Swanson, Article 4.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through Article 4, the property tax article, and again, I'll just kind of stick to some of the major items within this article and highlight some of the changes. Two new provisions that were in the Senate version of the tax bill start off the article, and those sections would allow watershed districts, construction, or implementation funds to receive grants from the state or federal government and levy for projects that receive those funds. The bill has two provisions that were in the House bill that allow county veteran service officers and local and county assessors to share data related to making eligibility determinations for the Disabled Veterans Homestead Exclusion. There's a small change from the original bill language in that we added local assessors, so this doesn't just apply to county assessors, it also applies to local assessors. There are a couple of property tax exemptions that were in the original House bill, one for agricultural historical societies, one for an Indian-owned pharmacy in the city of Minneapolis. There was one property tax exemption that was added, and that is for nonprofit licensed child care facilities. The two House provisions that allow shareholders of manufactured home park cooperatives to include a portion of their ground lease payments as property tax paid when they apply for property tax refunds is in the bill. And then there are a number of ag-related provisions. The House language for the trust properties, which would allow ag property owned by certain trust combinations to continue to qualify as homestead, is in the bill. There is a provision that allows land to continue to qualify as ag land, even if up to 3 acres of that land is used for certain environmental purposes. And there is a provision related to fractional homesteads. This provision was in the original House version of the bill, but there were some changes made to it. So the current version of this provision would only apply to ag property, and it would require that fractional ownership for ag homesteads owned by tenants in common to be determined based on the percentages shown in the county land records. The original language applied to all property types, and the original language also had a kind of a default portion to it where if that information wasn't available, we would just go, equal shares would just be used to determine the percentages. That piece has been removed. One other new provision related to agricultural homestead relates to business entities. So this bill would allow homestead qualifications for properties that are owned by one business entity but operated by a separate business entity. There's a date change for the recommendations of assessment values for state assessed property when they must be certified by the Department of Revenue, and that changed slightly from the original language in the bill. The current language would move that date from August 1 up to July 15th. There is a new state general levy abatement for certain natural gas pipelines. And as you mentioned in the introduction, Mr. Chair, there is a reduction in the state general property tax levy of $50 million. $47.5 million of that is reduced from the CI portion of the state general levy, and $2.5 million is reduced from the seasonal rec portion of the state general levy. In the original House tax bill, there were a number of provisions related to the disabled veterans' homestead market value exclusion. Two of those provisions are in this bill. One of those is that the application deadline is moved back from July 1 to December 15th, and the second provision that's in the bill would eliminate the 8-year limitation on the spousal benefit of the exclusion. There were also a number of provisions related to the senior deferral program in the original House language. One of those is in the current bill, and that is the movement of the application deadline from July 1 to November 1. And the final thing I'll mention from the property tax article is that there were, in the original bill, there were a number of provisions related to the Cloquet Area Fire and Ambulance District. Most of that language is the same in the current form of the bill, with one exception. So the current language does not exempt levies imposed to make debt service payments from the levy limits that are imposed for this district. The original language of the bill would have exempted those levies from those levy limits. And that concludes the property tax article.
Very good. Thank you very much. Article 5, aids and credits. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to kind of take the same approach to the aids and credits article, but rather than going through all of the changes one by one, I'm just going to kind of highlight what's in this article. Ms. Schill may go into a little bit more detail on some of these provisions if she's going to walk through the spreadsheet, but the bill summary has some more detailed information on the dollar amounts for some of the grants that I'll cover in just a few minutes. So one new provision in the aids and credits article is related to referendum equalization levies for school districts. So this is increases the second tier equalization factor of referendum revenue from $510,000 up to $576,000 beginning in fiscal year 21. The original House language of the Ag School Building Bond Credit increased the amount of the credit from 40% up to 70%. The current language still does that, but it phases in that increase over a number of years. There's an annual allocation of $750,000 to the Border Cities program. The original language had that at $1 million, so this is just a change of $250,000. There's a hold harmless provision for local government aid in 2020, and there are also increases to both local government aid and county program aid in the bill. Both aid programs will see an increase of $26 million in 2020, with an additional $4 million being added on to that beginning in 2021. The bill would allow the City of Austin to continue to allocate their fire pension aid between their Volunteer Fire Relief Association and their municipal fire pension. The City of Wavin will receive an LGA penalty forgiveness. And as I mentioned, there are a number of local government grants. These grants are for a variety of purposes and for a variety of amounts of money. But these grants will go to the counties of Beltrami, Manoman, Ottertail, and Wabasha. And then there are grants to the cities of Lilydale, Austin, Flensburg, Mazeppa, and Virginia. Mr. Chair, that concludes the aids and credits article.
Very good. Thank you much. Article 6, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 6 is almost identical to the local sales tax article that left the House floor, so I'm only going to talk about where there are differences. The Duluth general local sales tax is in this bill, but it's not in this article. It's actually in the Article 10, which deals with the Duluth medical area. So we'll talk about that when we get there. differences also, the House had a number of provisions related to what a local government will have to go through in the future to impose a tax. All of those were adopted. However, in Section 3, there was a paragraph added from the Senate that basically requires the Department of Revenue to retain a portion of excess revenues that might occur after a city has received all the revenues it's been allowed to raise, but because of the timing of when taxes have to terminate, and that money would go into the state general fund. The liquor, lodging, and restaurant tax, the lodging tax provision for the city of Minneapolis is slightly different. The House was going to take off their cap, and the Senate was just going to raise the cap. The compromise was to basically leave the cap in place but have the cap only apply to the total city tax rate applied to lodging, so that the city is not impacted if there's a new county tax or a new state tax increase. Other changes are the Senate, the House provided extra LGA for the cities of Scanlon and West St. Paul. Those are not provided in this bill anymore, and they are instead allowed the local sales taxes that they requested. Those came from the Senate. There is also a new food and beverage tax for the city of Sartell, and at the request of the Senate, that imposition of that tax will require voter approval at a general or special election by 2020. And that's really all the changes in that article.
Thank you very much. Article 7, tax increment financing. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and members, this article provides special authority to the cities of Hopkins, Bloomington, Edina, Alexandria, Anoka, Champlin, Roseville, Minneapolis, and Duluth. And some of these have changed from how the bill was passed on the House floor, so I'll just go over them quickly. The city of Hopkins was a Senate-only provision, which was introduced in the House, but was introduced after we had the property tax division had its TIF day hearing. So this one is just extending the pooling authority that is allowed by that district. The Bloomington five-year rule is extended by 6 years, and that is a little bit of a change from the 10 years that was in the original House bill. The city of Edina, for their redevelopment project area, will be able to establish districts for another 2 years. The cities of Alexandria and Anoka both got a three-year extension of the five-year rule, and again, those bills were introduced in the House, but too late for the TIF day hearing. The city of Champlin had a few provisions taken out, but we are extending the five-year rule to 10 years and extending the district's duration an additional 5 years. And then the cities of Duluth and Minneapolis will have a deemed redevelopment district that will not have to meet the statutorily required blight findings and also not have to spend increment on the blight correction. Minneapolis will also have a five-year rule extension to 10 years. And lastly, for Roseville, they will be allowed to expend increment inside the district that has already been collected. And the House bill that was passed off the floor also contained a provision for Burnsville, but that has been taken out for this version. And that, Mr. Chair, is the TIF article.
You good?
Mr. Chair, moving on.
Mr. Kleeman.
Mr. Chair, moving on to Article 8, which is the public finance article. This is similar to how the bill left the House. There are some differences. The first is that the two provisions relating to Met Council's bonding authority are not in the public finance article. I believe those are being carried in the transportation bill. Also, there was a Senate provision relating to public facilities bonds. This was for privately owned district heating and cooling facilities. That was not in the House bill. This bill, however, takes a Senate position, which did have that public facilities bonds provision in it. And I would also just call your attention to the fact that the House's transportation sales tax bonding provisions relating to county authority to issue those bonds after a public hearing, notice requirements, and inclusion in a capital improvement plan are in Article 8 of the House, or of this bill.
Very good. So Article 9, members, this is a portion that was not in the tax bill when it left this committee earlier in the year. Article 9.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. This is the extension, the repeal of the sunset on the Minnesota care taxes, and it changes the rate from 2% on these taxes to 1.8. These were moved from the Health and Human Service bill. These are all the tax provisions or some technical cross-reference provisions. The one section I would also note is Section 1, and it basically puts language in related to wholesale drug distributors who are from outside of the state, and this basically brings that language in compliance to the Wayfair case.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dalton.
You're
doing Article 10?
Mr. Chair, I am doing Article 10, too.
Very good.
Article 10 is the Duluth Regional Exchange District, which some people know as the Essentia Medical Center provisions for Duluth, similar to the Destination Medical Center for Rochester. This is very different from what was in the House tax bill, which was originally in the miscellaneous article. That basically just set up the board and the area and required some city funding. What this does is it allows some state appropriation bonds of up to $97.72 million and some state appropriations for this. The state appropriations are limited to $3.1 million in the first year and then $8.1 million a year for subsequent years. This provision eliminates the board and the planning and instead replaces it with a specific list of projects to be funded, which occur in Section 5. The city continues to have a share of the funding of these projects. It has to share parking revenue with the state, and it has to fund at least $10 million of the projects with the city utility fund or some of the money from their increased sales tax revenue. And finally, Section 7 of this article is the Duluth local sales tax, and it's essentially what was in the House bill, except that the amount dedicated to the regional exchange district has changed from $20 million to $10 million. And that is Article 10.
Very good. Ms. Hagler, Article 11.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 11 is the miscellaneous article, and if you recall, we did have a Article 4 special taxes, but that has just been rolled into this as it wasn't very long. So the first provision in that is a one that was not in the original bill, and it relates to a study of minimum wage in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that provision just allows the Department of Revenue to share information with the Federal Reserve Bank for that study. There are a number of provisions here that relate to the repeal of the requirement of for petroleum distributors to furnish bonds. And in place of that original language, there are provisions that deal with the suspension and revocation of those licenses for non-payment or non-filing of a return. There was some language in the special tax article related to obsolete discounted cigarette stamps, and so it's included in here. It's just repeal of obsolete language. There is an increase to the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund to $16 million. There are also provisions that were in the property tax article, or the aids and credits are one of those two articles, relating to taconite municipal aid, and I don't believe those have changed. And there are also provisions related to, sanitary sewer district that was just needed some retroactive language to make sure that their board members were in compliance. And then there is an appropriation for the Department of Revenue for the administration of this act. And if members are following along, on page 62 of the summary, there is an appropriation for taxpayer assistance grants, which says appropriates $400,000, but it should actually say $200,000. And then at the very end, there is a repealer for obsolete cigarette language and that petroleum bond requirement. And that is the miscellaneous article.
Very good. And it looks like articles 12 through 24 are the department policy and technical.
Yes.
Bills, and if you would just cover any changes in all 13 of those.
Yes,
articles.
Mr. Chair and members. So, yes, articles 12 through the end are the department's policy and technical articles that have not changed significantly, except that the partnership article has been removed, as well as the language relating to local lodging and travel intermediaries has been removed. What has been added to this section are the PRISM provisions that were originally in our property tax article and the cigarette and tobacco provisions relating to vapor products. And that concludes the summary.
Thank you very much. So any questions from members before we go to the spreadsheet? Just technical, not comments yet or anything, but questions on what might be in the bill. All right. Very good. I'm sorry, yeah, Representative Carlson.
A very quick one, Mr. Chairman. I know it wasn't in the House provision, but it last recited in Ways and Means. But if you look at page 29, item 9, ice arenas and rinks, there was a proposal for the National Sports Center, and it was my understanding it was moving on the Senate side, so that must not have either surfaced in the conference committee or I'm just curious if there was any discussion, because it's the same situation at the other rinks, nonprofit.
I don't remember any discussion, but Representative Lean, did you have something on this? Or is just a question? I don't, Ms. Dalton, anything to add?
Apparently it didn't surface.
No, it did not. It,
so that'll be
I don't recall any discussion on that.
Yeah, it's the same issue with the National Sports Center, and I met with some people earlier in the session.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Very good. Thank you. Anyone else? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is actually on a bill that Representative Hertaus carried. I appreciate you taking the lead on the bill. It's related to the stillborn tax credit, allowing families who live on in border communities who have had to go to a hospital in another state outside of Minnesota for that issue. Again, Representative Hertaus, I appreciate you taking the lead on that. It certainly impacts my constituents, but just wondering if that provision is also in the bill.
Representative Lee and Representative Hertaus, that did not. And there were concerns with some of the groups, and they felt they had not come to an agreement on it, so it just did not make it. All right. Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, if we can go to the spreadsheet and kind of with what we did with the overview, just major items and major changes.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
And I'm not defining major. Would that be $5 million or less or more, or what would that be? I don't know. But we'll leave that to your discretion. So please proceed.
Cynthia Templin, Mr. Chair, House Fiscal Staff. You should have the spreadsheet with a time stamp of May 23rd, 2019, 9:35 a.m. And the couple of provisions highlights we want to point out in this first summary page, the lines 1 through 14 cover the summary for the general fund changes relative to current law in the tax revenue and property tax expenditures. Just quickly, the bill raises, or it's actually almost at zero when you take the total revenue raised and the expenditures. There is a bottom line of $61,000 balance in the fiscal 2021 biennium. So it meets the target for the conference agreement.
Mr. Chair, that's on line 9.
Representative Hertaus, there's some amendment for your proposals. Well, maybe not enough. Please continue.
One other section of the summary page we just wanted to highlight is the budget reserve account. The budget reserve reduction is reflected in the summary page. That is in Article 11 of the bill. It is a reduction that affects the fiscal 22-23 biennium. And the spreadsheet shows a reduction of $469,000. We need to correct that. It should be $491,369,000.
Ms. Templin, what line was that from?
That's line 13. Oh, yeah, $491,369,000.
Okay.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, line 16 through 28 is a summary of the non-general funds, and we can talk about that more specifically as we proceed through the rest of the spreadsheet.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, moving on to page 2. Page 2 through page 7 are the changes to tax revenues in the bill, and the first the pages 2 through 4 cover all of the federal conformity changes relative to current law. And starting at the top of page 2, differences in the conference agreement relative to what was in the House bill. The conference agreement pretty much reflects the House, what was in the House bill. For as Mr. Williams described, the conference agreement does go to the TCGA standard deduction, or conforms to that at $24,400. In comparison, the House, or the governor and the Senate, had a standard deduction in the area of like $13,000. But the conference agreement, again, goes to the $24,000 standard deduction amount, $24,400 standard deduction amount. Towards the second half of the page, you see the changes with federal conformity to businesses, or the pass-throughs. One change to highlight is Section 179. The House bill had full conformity to Section 179 at 100%, and the conference agreement does not do full conformity, but retains the 80% add-back deduction. On the bottom of page 2, we show the corporate tax provisions, and again, the biggest change in the conference agreement to corporate taxes is again Section 179 and retaining the 80% add back. Page 3 of the spreadsheet, continuing with federal conformity changes to TCGA for corporate taxes, line 72, the conference agreement does not include the GILTI provision for CFC's controlled foreign corporation income. That is different from what was in the House proposal. There is no revenue from international income from businesses. And then the rest of the federal conformity pages are reflect the changes to the Bipartisan Budget Act and the Disaster Relief Act, and the conference agreement reflects pretty much the House position, or it does reflect the House position. There are no changes. So continuing on page 4, starting on line 127, we have individual income tax provisions that are not related to conformity. And one change in the conference agreement is the rate reduction at the second tier to 6.8%. This item has a cost of $360.8 million in fiscal 2021 and $318.3 million in the tails. And also on this page, you can see in tiny print, there is a working family credit provision. In the conference agreement, there are changes to the phase-out and the credit size for working family credit. The cost of these changes is a revenue reduction of $61.1 million in the 2021 biennium. And that is slightly different from what was in the House proposal. Those changes had a cost of $81.6 million. In addition, the conference agreement does include an increase to the Social Security subtraction. The conference agreement changes had an estimated revenue reduction of $9.1 million, and that is down from what passed the House at $20 million in the fiscal 2021 biennium. And then another difference in the conference agreement is for the Angel Tax Credit. The conference agreement funds it in the tails at $10 million for 1 year only, and what passed the House was funding at $20 million in the current biennium for two years. So total income tax changes, total revenue reductions is $430.8 million in the 2021 biennium and $400 million in the tails. Moving to corporate tax provisions, what is included in the conference agreement is very similar to it reflects a lot of what was in the House, what passed the House floor. There are revenue raisers for NOLs, modifying the NOL deduction, and the limitation on dividend DRDs for debt finance stock, and the mutual fund manager apportionment provisions. The combined revenue raised from these corporate tax changes are $88.1 million in the 2021 biennium and $71.3 million in the tails. Turning to page 5, we get to sales tax. The conference agreement does not include any changes to the data center to the data center exemption. That was in the House or what passed the House floor that raised $20.3 million, but the conference agreement does not include that. The conference agreement also includes many of the same exemptions by refunds for public safety facilities and a school district. There are also exemptions for property replacement that were affected by fires. And then finally, in the sales tax section on line 198, Ms. Dalton mentioned this, the June acceleration payment requirement. That is included in the conference agreement. The current law rate is 81.4%, and the conference agreement increases that percentage to 87.5% for June 2020 payments, but then reduces that requirement, that percentage, down from 87.5% to 84.5%. And on line 198, you can see the revenue impact of that provision. Those changes raise $23.8 million in the 2021 biennium, but there's a cost for reducing that percentage down in the tails of $11 million. Moving through the spreadsheet, Michelle, do you want to cover the statewide property?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Lines 208 through 213 reflect changes in the statewide property tax. What the conference committee agreed to is reflected on lines 209 and 210. First, Mr. Swanson mentioned the $50 million per year reduction in the statewide general levy amount. And let me comment on that. It's $50 million per year, but as you go across the spreadsheet and see an impact of 77.5, remember, this tax is imposed on a calendar year basis, but we track things on a fiscal year basis. And so that first half, that first 6 months that you see in fiscal 20 is about 55% of those collections. So that's why you see 27.5, and then you add it to the $50 million to get the 77.5. So we do know how to do math. We just watch on exactly what comes in. And then you'll see each 50-year in the tails in fiscal 22 and 23. Line 210 also has, and this was from the Senate, the exemption for natural gas pipeline property, and that's really a negative because it impacts only a few properties.
And then on page 5 of the spreadsheet, the bottom half of the page, there are cigarette and tobacco product taxes. In the bill that passed the House, there were changes to the rate for tobacco and cigarettes with the reinstatement of indexing, and the conference agreement does not include that, and nor does it include any of the additional or new surcharges or excise taxes on vapor products that were included in the Senate tax bill. Turning the page now to page six, the conference agreement does not have any changes that affect alcohol excise taxes and estate taxes and lawful gambling taxes. And then starting on line 242 of page six, we have a section for other tax provisions. And the conference agreement does include a provision for tax penalties waived for special TCGA waivers for tax year 2018 and 2019 only. And this does have a revenue reduction starting in fiscal 19 of $258,000 and a reduction of $885,000 in the fiscal 2021 biennium. Line 248 of this spreadsheet, this was discussed in the House Research Summary, Border Cities. The conference agreement funds it at $750,000 annually and ongoing. That is just slightly down from what it was in the bill that passed the House at $1 million per year. And then finally, on line 249 of the spreadsheet, this is a provision that is new, that was not in the House bill or any of the other tax bills. This is a provision that eliminates the TANF transfer to the general fund for the working family credit. Basically, the general fund picks up what the TANF fund was originally paying for with the refunds for the working family credit. And this has a cost of $48.815 million in the 2021 biennium and $50 million in the tails. On line 253, then, we have a total for that sums all of these changes that have been discussed that affect that all of the changes from federal conformity and non-federal conformity provisions. You can see on line line 253, fiscal 19, the total changes are a positive $22.6 million. And in the fiscal 2021 biennium, $79.3 million is raised. And finally, in the tails, $224.694 million is raised to the general fund from the changes in the tax bill.
Mr. Chair and members, pages 7 and 8 cover the changes for property tax aids and credits. And in general, let me comment. The total spending here is about $102 million in fiscal 2021. That's about $50 million less in aids and credits and refunds than what left the House. And in fiscal 22-23, the total spending is $222 million, or about $110 million less in spending. And getting more specific, you can see on lines 1 through 35, this covers all the changes and refunds. And I won't go over the small interactions that we commonly discuss and track, but I will mention this, that the biggest, the lion's share of the difference is that you will not see either the increases in homestead credit state refund or the renter's credit. These did not make it in the final agreement. So sorry, Mr. Chair. In addition to that, you will not see Met Council bonds. I think Mr. Swanson mentioned that that is being carried in the transportation bill, so nothing having to do with that is in this section. Similarly, what was not agreed to was any funding in this bill for soil and water conservation districts. As I understand it, that's in the legacy being funded with clean water monies. So you will not see that in this section, and therefore the overall impact that you see here has is significantly less than what it was when it left the House. Lines 37 through 59 is the age section, and as Mr. Swanson mentioned, we have funding increase for local government aid. You'll see the $26 million increase in fiscal 21 and then $30 million in each year in the tails. Similarly, the increase for county program aid is found on line 45, and that is funded similarly, $26 million in the first year, $30 million in each year of the tails. What also you will see is one-time funding this for the city of Virginia, that, as it left the bill here in the House, was in fiscal 20. The conference committee agreed to funding that in fiscal 22. There's money for Lilydale, Flensburg LGA forgiveness, and let me see, Melrose fire remediation, Austin fire forgiveness, Mazeppa. Those items, many of them were funded in fiscal 19. We moved all of that payout into fiscal 20. Moving on to the next page, you will see on the very first line of page 8, line 52, this is school operating referendum equalization aid. The Senate bill carried a line for referendum equalization levy changes, and this aid was actually carried by the House in the education bill at a level of $25 million. So $25 million in the House Education Committee, $15 million in the Senate tax bill. What the compromise was, what you see on line 52, is $10 million per year starting in fiscal 21. Now, once again, we know how to do math. Education funding is paid out on a 90-10 level. So what you see here is funding $8.99 million per year, or excuse me, for fiscal 21, and then it changes in the tail. So that's part of how education is funded. The Senate, in their bill on line 55, had a grant of $750 million to Manoman with some specific ways of paying that money out. The conference committee agreed to $500,000 as the amount in fiscal 20, with the remainder to be taken care of by the increase in CPA that I already talked about. What you will not see in this aid section is funding for the PERA, Public Employees Retirement Assistance. That sunset extension was not agreed to by the conference committee, but what was included is PERA MRF, which was carried in the state government bill, and that is found in the other section on line 77 here. That appropriation is $10 million per year starting in fiscal 20. Line 61 through 71, you will see credits, and the major changes there is what Mr. Swenson commented on. Line 64, the school ag build bonding credit, it is increasing to 50% in fiscal 21, and that total is $9.8 million. Then in fiscal 22, 55%, that amount is $17.5 or so. And then the 60% increase is would cost $26.3 million. The language also carries forward, and you'll see this on the label on the spreadsheet, that particular program will be at 70%, and that will start in fiscal 24, which is outside the forecast window. So remaining here, line 73 through 83 are other items. Senior property tax deferral date, the MRF money. Oh, yes, on line 78, you'll see an appropriation for Essentia, which is the medical center that Ms. Dalton talked about. The debt service appropriation there is $3 million in fiscal 22 and $8.1 million in years after, starting in fiscal 23. Taxpayer volunteer tax assistance grants at the $200,000 level per year is line 80. And lastly, on line 82 is an appropriation for the administration of all of these changes in this omnibus tax bill to the Department of Revenue, $3 million per year starting in fiscal 20. Total spending, as I mentioned before, zero in fiscal 19. For fiscal 2021, $101.86 million, and fiscal 22-23, $222.63
million. Ms. Templin, so the rest of the way, I think there's mainly not, maybe just one area that we really need to talk about.
Yes.
So who wants to cover that? So, Ms. Schill?
Yes. Mr. Chair, on pages 9 and 10, we have non-general fund changes. And what you are referring to, Mr. Chair, is the addition of the lines in the Health Care Access Fund reflected on lines 55 through 59. And it's particularly line 57, the provider tax rate change from 2% to 1.8%. The impact of that repeal is $872.6 million in fiscal 2021 and $1.421 billion in fiscal 22 and 23. Pages 11 and 12 are just boring stuff with interactions. So we are done, Mr. Chair.
Is that a technical term, boring stuff?
Of course it is.
Very good. Ms. Schill, Ms. Templin, thank you. Anyone before they leave the table have any questions regarding the spreadsheet? Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, one thing I didn't want to overlook. The spreadsheet that you have in front of you does not contain the tab with the no state impact costs, but I have been tallying it, and I do have it, and we can post it if you would like.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know exactly if this is for the fiscal staff or the research staff, but I'm just wondering on the conformity revenue raisers. Now, are these largely going to be one-time revenue raisers, or is this going to be ongoing, you know, beyond 2025, 2026?
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, if you refer to the spreadsheet, you can see which items are temporary and which items are ongoing. So, for example, on page 2 of the spreadsheet, if you refer to the effective date column, you see effective dates that show like tax year 19. If it shows tax year 19, that means that the revenue is ongoing. If the effective date shows like tax year 19 through 25, that That denotes that that revenue or any of the changes from the provision in for federal conformity that impact the revenues will sunset by tax year 29 and are not considered permanent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. All right, so next we're going to go to testimony, and we're first going to call on Commissioner Bowerly, and if she makes her way to the table, I just, you know, the thing to remember when you put a bill together like this is there's really three major bodies. There's the House, the Senate, and then there is the governor's office. And I just really want to thank Governor Walz and Speaker Hortman and Majority Leader Gazelka for reaching an agreement in a very, with some really tough decisions that everyone had to make. They really did. I mean, there were some really big issues on the table this year, and we are the only divided government in the nation. We have one body as a Democrat and one as a Republican.
All the time.
And it's the fact that they could come to a conclusion on some really, really tough issues. So, again, I want to thank Governor Walz and Speaker Hortman and Majority Leader Gazelka for doing that, and also to the three of them for setting up this process. Because I know the Senate held their tax hearing earlier today, and all the committees on all the bills are holding these informational meetings, which, again, in my 19 years is unique when it comes to a special session like we're at. And as I mentioned that, I also want to thank the Senate and the tax conferees. I didn't do that earlier, but Chair Chamberlain just was excellent to work with. He and his Senate, the tax committee there, and the Senate brought over some very, very good components that are in this bill. And so it really brought a lot of people together. So I want to thank Chair Chamberlain and the Senate conferees and the Senate for that. And with Commissioner Bowerly, one nice thing about this whole process is that Commissioner Bowerly in the governor's office was a huge partner in putting this bill together. And the provisions that you brought forward with the governor added also very strongly to the bill. And I just think this is a good example of how you get bills through. Ultimately, is you not only compromise between Democrats and Republicans, but you also bring the governor's office in and work hand in hand with making this goal. So, Commissioner Bowerly, thank you so much for all of your work and what you brought to the table and the provisions that you and the governor have in the administration of this bill. And I also want to thank your staff, Commissioner Bowerly, for the wonderful job they've done this session. And anytime we needed information, we had it. I know they worked long and hard hours, too. So thank you so much, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I think, Mr. Chair, you said it well. This is a compromise bill. There are elements in this bill that were not in the governor's bill, but were in the Senate bill. There are elements in this bill that were in the Senate and in the House and the governor's bill that were not in the Senate bill. And so this really is, I think, as you described it, a true compromise bill. There are some very good elements of this bill for many different types of taxpayers in Minnesota. As Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan set out their budget earlier this year, they were focused on affordable health care, education, and community prosperity. And so many of the elements of this tax bill really do support that vision for Minnesota. Mr. Chair, we're incredibly pleased that the House's version of the working family credit is in this bill. It will include an important expansion for workers, single workers, childless workers, who, of course, have children in their lives. They just don't claim them at dependents, making sure that we can get people working their way toward the middle class. The governor from the beginning has been committed to important investments in LGA and CPA and the services that that will deliver to Minnesota communities across the state of Minnesota. We appreciate so much the Ag School Bond Credit provisions in this bill. And the House Research and Fiscal have gone through the bill, and so you all have a picture of what's in it. So I won't go through individual items, but I will also acknowledge that one of the most important things for every taxpayer in Minnesota is the changes that were made to respond to the federal law changes. So some of it is conformity and some of it is not conformity, but it is an important move for us to make here in Minnesota that will make tax filing simpler for all Minnesotans going forward. We appreciate so much the opportunity to double our standard deduction, which will benefit so many Minnesotans and make their tax filing even easier. There are, of course, conformity on that domestic income for businesses, and although the governor's proposal did also seek to include conformity with the full conformity with the federal approach on foreign income, that is not in this bill. Again, it is a compromise bill. We are incredibly pleased that this bill is carrying the repeal of the sunset for the provider tax that will ensure affordable health care for all for Minnesotans and will ensure that many of our children and elderly and the people with disabilities have access to the important programs that are funded through the health care access the health care access fund. Obviously, the jurisdiction for exactly how that gets done is in another committee, but I think it is an important part of the way that we bring resources to the table to serve Minnesotans. So, Mr. Chairman, I just really want to thank you. You have done a great job this session in hearing many, many bills, having a wonderful, deep conversation about taxes. Not everyone likes to discuss taxes. They are a fundamental part of our how we as a society help fund the needs and the resources that we need across the state of Minnesota. There are obviously disagreements about how we do that and with whom and for whom. And what I do think is important is that we are able to have a conversation that is based in fact and in numbers, and that is part of the department's job, is to bring that data to you. So we appreciate the role that we get to play here in the committee as well. I would also like to thank the committee administrator, Mr. Jessen, for all the great work in helping us stay organized and know how to reach you and provide information to members as you have questions. I can't thank enough the incredible House Research and Fiscal Analyst staff, Sean Williams, Chris Klayman, Pat Dalton, Alex Hagler, Jared Swanson, Cynthia Templin, and Catherine Schill. We work incredibly closely with them, and we, over the last few days, have asked them to do incredible work, and we are incredibly grateful. I will join you, Mr. Chairman, in thanking the team at the Department of Revenue, the Property Tax Research Division, the research division that covers all other tax types. As you know, they provide services to the department and the governor, and they also provide confidential service to all of you. So you can seek their expertise and their data and their analysis for whatever ideas that the legislature is considering, and they provide that to you on a confidential basis. And I need to thank my policy and legal team at the department as well for all of their long, long hours this session, building a budget and then getting us through this process. So I want to thank them. Mr. Chairman, as this bill moves forward, what I will tell you is that the Department of Revenue is eager to get to work to make these the tax cuts and the changes to our system in this bill into a reality for Minnesotans. So we thank you for the time, and we thank you for your hard work this session, Mr. Chairman, and we are pleased that we were able to reach a compromise bill on four taxes that will move the system forward and will help fund needed services for health care in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Bowerly, thank you so much. Appreciate that. So members, what we're going to do now is go to other testifiers. We're going to put a two-minute limit on, because we don't know for sure how many it may be before we're done. So we'll start with Mr. Laurie and then Mr. Peterson. And if you both would come down, and then I'll always say kind of who's on deck. So Stu Laurie and Bradley Peterson. Mr. Laurie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. I'll keep it very brief. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota's Farmers Union. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you for what is a good bill for Minnesota's farmers. As you know, farmers in Minnesota and across the country have come on some tough times. We've got a trade war, unpredictable weather, high input prices and all those have come together to contribute to the lowest on-farm income that we've seen in 23 years or since the university started collecting that data. So with those challenges in mind, I want to thank you for this bill and call out three provisions that will make a huge difference for family farmers and our members. First being, of course, that ag-to-school tax credit, which when it phases up to 70% will provide significant property tax relief for farmers and really is a win-win for those farmers and their communities. Also, so appreciate the significant moves towards full conformity with Section 179 for equipment expensing, particularly when we hopefully see the ag economy turn around and farmers are able to invest in new equipment. That'll make a huge difference for them. And finally, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you so much for your work on the homestead eligibility fix that will help farmers, you know, and particularly important to us is making sure that farmers are able to pass their farm on to the next generation, and that'll be a big help in doing that. So bottom line, this is a good bill for farmers at a time that we really need it, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and all your staff for all your great work on this.
Thank you very much. Next up, Bradley Peterson and Nan Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. The last time I was before the committee testifying, I indicated that getting local government aid back to the 2002 level was our organization's top goal. And so, Mr. Chair, it is very gratifying to be able to sit here celebrating that. One of the things that I tell folks about local government aid is that even though it is a relatively small amount of the state general fund budget, between 2 and 3%, it makes a huge impact in our communities across the state, especially in rural Minnesota. It is the firefighter, it is the cop, it is the librarian, it is the parks department, it is all the things that make Minnesota communities great. And Mr. Chair, since successes like this have many parents, I want to thank several people, starting with Governor Walz and Commissioner Bowerly and the leadership that they showed in terms of putting it in their budget. Mr. Chair, your leadership, Representative Loeffler, your leadership, the legislators around the table, such as Representative Liz Lagarde, Representative Brand, who have carried bills to increase this amount. It is a team effort, and our cities sincerely, sincerely appreciate the partnership that we have with the state. And finally, Mr. Chair, on my own behalf, I am so thankful that I'm not going to have to talk anymore about getting LGA back to the 2002 level. I don't think I could have gone on.
Thank you very much. Nan Madden and Rachel Zemmer is on deck. Ms. Madden, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to a few items in the bill. Especially need to thank you for the expansion of the Working Family Credit. This will help workers and families all across the state better afford what they need to succeed at work and get their kids off to a stronger start. Really appreciate that this bill makes important improvements to the credit for certain families and workers that weren't as well served by the credit in its current form, including both larger families and workers without dependent children. I want to thank in particular, thank you, Mr. Chair, thank Representative Brand, Representative Gomez, Representative Loeffler for authoring Working Family Credit bills this session, as well as the many other committee members on both sides of the aisle who have supported this issue both this year and in the past. Also want to thank that the tax conformity portion of the bill continues to take family size into account by maintaining dependent exemptions. And we also strongly support maintaining the provider tax. That's really an essential revenue source that helps support affordable health care for over 1 million Minnesotans. One of our concerns with the bill is we do oppose taking the funds from the budget reserve. We think that was really a lost opportunity to raise the revenues we need to sustainably fund essential public services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Yes, ma'am, thank you so much. So Rachel Zemmer and then John Peterson. I don't see Rachel. All right, so John Peterson and then Dominic McQuarrie.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair.
Welcome. State your name.
Yep, I'm John Peterson. I represent the Semstone family of companies. I provided this memo for you in your packet in regard to the June accelerated exclusion payment, and it's it certainly goes without saying we're disappointed. We started with a bill that would have exempted building material suppliers from this tax, and instead it's been increased significantly. So the reason why this is such a hardship for building material suppliers is outlined in this memo. It was produced for the bill authors, Representative Walgamott and Senator Ralph, simply because, these building material suppliers are unlike most businesses that collect, when they collect, make a sale, like a car dealer or a retail store, they have the money before that customer leaves the store to make that sales tax payment. These building material suppliers have to extend terms of 30, 60, 90, and quite frankly, on state and federal jobs, those terms extend well beyond that in terms of the construction projects that are funded. And so I would just like to draw your attention to that. And to be honest with you, I don't see an answer when we have an economy that's significantly over 2% growth, and yet you still have to come back to these businesses to raise money and solve this problem. You know, I've heard it described as a balancing mechanism or accounting mechanism. I hope you're realizing this is just padding the state's checkbook right before the end of the fiscal year. That's why this is happening. And I think you all understand that. And the hardship that it's creating for a significant amount of businesses in this state. And so I'll thank you for your hard work as well. But I would also ask you, as you go back into your districts, to please be sure to remember to go to the lumber yards, ready mix plants, block plants, paint stores, cabinet shops, shingle suppliers, and thank them for them funding this bill, in part funding this bill, because that's who you've asked to fund it, and ask them to go borrow more money at a very difficult time of the year. To make this early sales tax payment, and I would encourage you to do that as you head back into your districts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Dominic McQuarrie and Amber Hansen Glazier. Is on deck. Please proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dominic McQuarrie, Public Policy Manager at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. Want to give a shout-out to the Working Family Credit expansion. Thank you for that. And once we see the Health and Human Services bill, I hope that the transfer back to the TANF block grant will show some positive results there for the cash assistance as well. But today I'm here mostly on behalf of the This Is Medicaid Coalition, a broad coalition of over 50 organizations that works to protect the health care of Minnesotans who receive it through Medicaid. And we're here to express gratitude today that you listened to the hundreds of people from around the state who called, signed letters, came to visit you in person, calling for the repeal of the sunset of the provider tax and protecting the care of over 1 million Minnesotans. A key linchpin in the healthcare system of almost every state, including Minnesotans, including Minnesota's, is the provider tax. And the repeal of the sunset means that it'll be in place, supporting the health of Minnesotans for decades to come. So for This Is Medicaid, it's, yes, about taxes, but it really means that a Minnesotan diagnosed with cancer will be able to afford their treatment, that the birth of a child will be a time of joy rather than financial worry. And that someone who's in need of mental health treatment will be able to receive it when they truly need it. So again, we thank you for making a tough choice, but one that's really going to have strong impact in keeping people, families, and communities from Thief River Falls to Winona, St. Paul to St. Cloud, strong and healthy as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Glazer is next, and I have no one else on the list, so if anyone else wants to speak, if you'd please come down and take the on-deck chair. So, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Amber Hansen Glazer. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. I just wanted to take a brief moment to thank you for keeping Minnesota farmers and ranchers in mind as you put this tax bill together. Throughout the session, we've talked a lot about the financial and emotional challenges that farmers across the state have been facing. And provisions in this bill will go a long ways to help farmers weather these tough times. I'd like to thank you especially for the increase in the Ag to School Bond Tax Credit. As you've heard many times over the last few weeks and months, how big of a difference this is going to make to farmers' bottom lines. And I want to thank you, especially, Mr. Chair, for your leadership on this issue and for continuing to listen to farmers and ranchers as they talk about property taxes and how we can continue to improve that system. I'd also like to just thank you for the language included regarding the homestead tax credit fix, the county fair's sales tax exemption, and the progress we've made on Section 179. Again, this has some really important provisions for farmers and ranchers, and I'd like to thank the leadership on this committee, as well as in the Senate, as well as all the time that the conference committee put in to put it to get a good compromise bill put together. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anyone else care to testify on the bill? And please, if anyone else wants to, please take the chair at this time, the on-deck chair. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I don't get over to tax as much, and it's always nice to have a change of scenery. I want to thank, for Schools for Equity and Education, really wants to thank you for the $10 million in referendum equalization that's contained in the bill, and also, as many others have said, the increase in the ag bond credit. We represent school districts throughout the state that are property poor. Increase in equalization will certainly help districts that are have already passed levies, and in some cases those districts that are seeking to narrow the gap between themselves and districts at the higher end of the revenue stream. I want to thank our authors, Representative Hewitt. I think Representative Runbeck also had a bill on referendum equalization. I want to thank the House staff for all that they've done, and again, I'm glad to be over in taxes every now and then, so thanks.
Good to see you. Thank you so much. Would anyone else like to testify on, well, it's not a bill yet, the proposed bill that will be introduced during special session? If not, members, discussion. Okay. So, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for working on this tax bill. It was really important that we retained the provider tax to have revenue for over 1 million people to afford their health care. And I also want to thank you for working on MFIP and helping the HHS committee on those issues. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Schultz, and thank you for your work on health and human services. And I know you've been a leader in trying to keep the provider tax. So thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just also want to thank you and the conferees for including the school equalization levy and the ag bond levy. It really does help our schools and helped out the education bill, too.
Anyone? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think speaking for this side of the aisle, too, we just appreciate the fairness and opportunity to be able to address our concerns with you and the respectful manner in which we have held this meeting. Chair Davids, I know, would have a lot more flowery language to use. I can't fill his shoes, but I do just want to say thank you, and I appreciate all the work that you do. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. Anyone else? Well, I don't know for sure. Thank you. I don't know for sure when special session will be held. I'm sure it's going to be soon. But the process with this bill would be introduced and then go from there. So, again, I appreciate everyone's work. I think this is a tax bill that is going to make a difference in people's lives, improve people's lives, help our working families and our senior citizens, our farmers and our small businesses, and that's what we try to do here. So with that, members, we'll have more discussion on the House floor at some point in the next upcoming days. But again, appreciate your work. And with that, we are adjourned.